Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Salt Lake City author Deborah Frank about her new book, Faint Heart Never Climbed a Mountain, a century of adventure, history, and exploration from the Wasatch Mountain Club. As the Wasatch Mountain Club's historian, Deborah Frank has compiled more than 60 true stories from the club's 100-plus year history, featuring true stories of hiking, climbing, skiing, bicycling, kayaking, canyoneering, and snowshoeing throughout the American West. And readers of the book encounter avalanches, lightning strikes, wildlife encounters, close calls, unforgettable wilderness experiences, along with stories that inspire exploration and a deeper appreciation for the outdoors. The essayist and memoirist Deborah Wilson Frank is Wasatch Mountain Club's historian. As I said, always a bookworm, she spent a decade with Borders Books and Music, serving as their first vice president of store operations. And when life took her to Utah, she reignited two of her childhood passions, writing and hiking. This book is a culmination of both. She holds an MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts, has published widely, including essays in Rumpus, Brevity's Blog, and the anthology Being Home, edited by Sam Pickering and Bob Kunziger. Deborah Frank, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating book. A lot of fun stories here, harrowing stories as well. Love stories as well. As a lover of love stories, couples were formed in the Wasatch, Mountain Club's history over the breadth of history. We'll talk about that as we go along. So tell me about, did you get into hiking in outdoors when you came to Utah, or was it before that?
Oh, it was before that. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the Seattle area. And when my parents divorced when I was nine, my dad didn't know what to do with my sister and me on his Sunday afternoons. So he took us to Mount Rainier, which was a very lovely thing. And we hiked all over Mount Rainier throughout my childhood.
Yeah. So Julie Kilgore, who writes the foreword here, she's the immediate past president of the Wasatch Mountain Club. She says that when she moved to the West, I guess she hadn't really done much of this. So somebody said, hey, you got to get up in the mountains. And so she started with easy hikes and then started more strenuous and noticed that she was hiking alone and decided, well, that's probably not safe.
That is true. having encountered a mama grizzly with three cubs on my own and having been charged by a not too happy moose. Hmm. I can say that hiking alone is not a good idea and it's less fun.
Yeah. Right, less fun, yeah. by the way, what mama grizzly with her cubs, what do? You just back away slowly? What do you do?
Oh, boy. That's what I did after I screamed.
Oh, no.
I know. But, it's just so instinctive and not in a good way. I screamed. And then I backed up to where my partner was, and we were wearing bear spray right at chest level where you're supposed to, and unhooked it. We radioed our friends who were behind us, and then we just tried to take deep calming breaths and started back on the trail, and happily mama and cubs were no longer where they were.
Yeah.
No, it was scary. Mm-hmm. I was only about 20, 30 feet away from them.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. So you had bear spray. Yes. Luckily, you didn't have to use it this occasion. Does it work? I guess.
It does, yes. But when it's a mama with three cubs, that's probably not a great combination.
Yeah.
Your best defense is to have at least two people and your odds get better as you have more people with you. Mm-hmm. If you're with four other people, you're not going to be charged by a bear.
Okay. The bear will calculate the risk, I guess, whatever the bear does. What about the moose? How'd you get out of that thing?
Okay. So I live in Immigration Canyon, and I'm very fortunate to have Killian's right up the street from me. So I hike there every day. And I just kind of take it for granted because it's my neighborhood. But I was coming down alone and jogging, and I did not see him until after he saw me. And again, he was maybe 30 feet away and looking right at me. There was nowhere to go, really, just step off the trail a little bit into some brush, which is what I did, because you don't have a lot of time to think about these things. And it was like, whoop! It happened in an instant, and he is right next to me. And happily, he let that be a warning to me, and he took off again. And the only bad part was that then he was between me and my car, and I had to turn around and go the other way, and many miles out of the way.
Oh boy. And you know, the moose is a very large animal. It's scary.
Oh, they're huge.
So it was Julie Kilgore, I understand, who encouraged you to you were thinking the 100th anniversary of the Wasatch Mountain Club's coming up, and you were the historian, so you'd write some articles, and she said, well, why not a book, right?
Yes, she did. And that's Julie. Actually, I was not the historian then. That's only been in the last couple of years. I had only been a club member for about 4 years, but we were coming up on the 2020, coming up on 2020, which is the centennial of the club. Not the best year to choose because we had all kinds of events scheduled, but Julie had in mind a book, and I thought that's a really good idea. It's probably going to be a lot of work, but from what little I knew, there were a lot of stories that really should be told. So it was an opportunity.
So COVID times, and the club was formed in the aftermath of the great flu.
Blue, yes, it's a strange book ending.
So what, tell me about your research. Well, how did you, I guess a lot of interviews with folks, and what else did you do?
Well, I started with reading Ramblers. Now, the club has a newsletter that dates back to 1922. And so I started reading all of those. And for more information, I went to this wonderful resource, newspapers.com, where I could find things that did not show up in the club newsletter. From there, I just started collecting a lot of information, because it's such a great number of years, a great number of people, and a great many activities. So the idea was to take it all in and then see how it arranged itself into a book, and follow up with lots of interviews with club members, as well as the University of Utah Marriott Library. And again, a lot came back to newspapers.com.
So the club has been into many things. We'll talk about the chapters are arranged by activity. So you got mountaineering and canyoneering and water rafting and caving and climbing. I guess some skiing as well, right? And
Being definitely.
over the history of the club, you had what, basketball, volleyball, those kind of fell away.
They fell away. Initially, in the 1920s, they did play basketball. I think that just fell away. Whereas other things like canyoneering, when that came on board, that became, was thoroughly embraced by club members and has become one of the biggest attractors to the club, because people want to get into canyoneering, and it's something you need a lot of expertise on. Basketball, anybody can do a pickup game in a back lot. Canyoneering, you really can't take that on your own.
Let's get back into the history again. We're talking with Deborah Frank. Her new book is Faint Heart Never Climbed a Mountain, A Century of Adventure, History, and Exploration from the Wasatch Mountain Club. And that's it's available now. How can you get the book?
Right now, it's available on my website, which is deborahwilsonfrank.com. It's recently been picked up by the King's English. And other than that, it will be carried eventually by the new Utah History Museum. And it's only been out a couple weeks, so I'm still working on getting it into more outlets.
Okay. So if you're in the Salt Lake area, the King's English, and otherwise, DeborahWilsonFrank.com is
That's
where to
correct.
go. So let's go back to the early 20th century. The official founding was 1920, but there was a date before that, June 13th, 1913. 13 people met to form this club. I just want to read this. Charles Stoney was a driving force behind the club. He believed young people spent too much time out indoors and that outdoor recreation was healthful and invigorating. Well, that brings us right to today.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, so I guess that was an impetus for this. What was the purpose? There was a charter that you quote in the book. What were the main purposes of forming the club?
Okay, there was conservation in it right from the beginning, but also education, to know about the geology and the botany, to have an appreciation for all aspects of nature, and to, they called it advertise the sites of Utah. They felt that people should have the opportunity to be out there and experience the mountains as things of beauty. They had been primarily a source of mining.
Mm-hmm.
Something in the way. And club members saw them as something beautiful that everybody should be made aware of.
Mm.
But they had a prominent geologist in the original group of members who would lead geology talks, for example. So they really embraced the science as well as the recreation and the camaraderie.
So you brought up an important point here. This is the opening part of the book here. In the early 20th century, I'll just quote you, Salt Lake City's Wasatch Mountains were considered dangerous. Mining companies had extracted almost everything of mineral value, then departed, leaving behind open shafts and debris. So at that point, early 1900s, the mountains, we don't necessarily go up into the mountains. It's dangerous up there. And that's hard for me to wrap my mind around, because I've grown up in an era where the mountains are for recreation.
Exactly. But another aspect of this is that it was not easy to get to the mountains. There were about 90 miles of paved road in Salt Lake City in the 20s, early 20s, and they didn't lead right up to a trail. And the way that was one of the reasons for founding the club is that you could get your buddies together and rent an open back truck and you could actually reach the mountains. And that was a big, big deal for the club.
Yeah.
It was a way to get to them. Yeah. Not just your horse and buggy.
I'm trying to find this. There's here it is. Page 17. One of the people is reminiscing. Do you recall the days of the J&M or B&O trucks? We used to ride in freight or coal hacks and moving vans, sit on bare boards with no backrests. In case of rain or snow, you just waited for the snow to end.
Yes,
they were
right.
Thinking fondly back to these times.
That actually was written in 1924, fondly remembering that they were still very much, that's how they got around.
Yeah. So tell me, you have a chapter here on some of the prominent, excursions of the 1920s. Maybe tell me about one.
Yes. Let's see. The Lone Peak, the trip to Lone Peak in 1921 was interesting because they did have to take, one of those open back trucks that you mentioned. And it was a 2-day, well, really a 3-day excursion back then. You have the trucks drop you off on Friday night, and you have your quilt, because you didn't have a sleeping bag back then. You had meals for, enough food for 7 meals. And what they did is they backpacked partway in, and then they just slept outside. Picked up the next day and could at least leave behind some of their stuff and head up to Lone Peak. But what they had was a handwritten note telling them Well, kind of stick to the right and keep climbing. And when you get to the piles of stones, just keep to the right, and maybe you'll find it. And that's what they did, because back then you did not have prominent trails. You had they came to the remains of a mining camp, those sorts of things. But they were explorers. They were pioneers doing this. And they thought it was too rough for women. That took a couple more years.
And there's a part in the book where somebody's talking about, can't remember whether it's hiking or climbing. He says it's a manly man sport, but then you note that there are more women than men
There
in
were
this
indeed.
activity.
Yes, there were more women. They did the tough stuff. A lot of Utahns will be familiar with Angel's Landing in Zion National Park, and that's where they have, present day, they have cables to pull yourself up. Well, back in 1924, they did not. And there's a lovely article about that, that they were, the Wasatch Mountain Club was the first group after two rangers went to the top, and there were no cables. And as the article declares, there were even girls on that trip.
I can't imagine Angel's Landing without cables. That's
Yeah, I've done it with cables, and it's spooky enough to, to look down.
that's amazing. Well, this might, before we go to break, this might be a good time to bring this in. This I my listeners know I may or may not read romance novels. I'll deny it in manly circles, but you write that many club couples met, especially on bike rides, you say.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily that it was always on bike rides, but as I found a theme for each of my activities in each chapter, it just emerged that the stories I found were people who met on bike rides. But way back in the 1930s, before biking was even an activity of the clubs, they were often called WMC, Wasatch Mountain Club, Wasatch Matrimonial Club,
Oh, really?
which,
Wow.
yes. And so, I think the numbers were back in the 1930s, there were only about 130 members, and most of the married people had met in the club.
Yeah, that's amazing. I guess it makes sense. You're out there doing a shared interest, right? And then.
Yeah, even the club founders both met their wives in the club. One of them for better and one of them for worse.
Oh, I
But
see. Okay.
yes, one of the founders was when he got married, the club kidnapped him on his wedding night and didn't return him for 2 days, and his wife never forgave him.
Oh no. Oh
Yeah. The
no.
other one skied with the co-founder. His wife skied with him, hiked with him. They did every outdoor activity you could imagine.
Well, let's do take a break. We're talking with Deborah Frank. The new book is Faint Heart Never Climbed a Mountain, a century adventure, history and exploration from the Wasatch Mountain Club. We'll have much more with this following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Salt Lake City author Deborah Frank. Her new book is Faint Heart Never Climbed a Mountain. It's 100 Years of the Wasatch Mountain Club. And that's available at deborahwilsonfrank.com and at the King's English Bookshop at this point. So, Deborah Frank, I wonder if we could have you tell another one of your stories, Biking with a Bison.
Oh,
That's
yes.
in chapter 12.
That is. So biking was always considered kind of a fair weather sport in the club. It was something that was done on warm, sunny days. It was not ever undertaken in snow, rain, those sorts of things. But Julie Kilgore, who was the club president for 9 years, organized a bicycle trip to Yellowstone, And this was done very deliberately after the snow was cleared from the roads, but before they were open to car traffic. And the great thing about that is you have the park to yourself. However, you have the park to yourself, as in without cars, the animals are still there. And so on Julie's second annual trip to do a bike ride in Yellowstone, they had all kinds of weather. And one of our club members hadn't really understood that she really needed to be prepared for all kinds of weather. And it absolutely poured rain. She was unprotected and was very cold. And so as they are returning to where they started at the West Gate, she's very cold. She's got to get back. And up ahead are a bunch of leisurely strolling bison, like 20 of them, and they are filling the whole road. And the national, the park regulations are that you should not get closer than 75 feet from bison, which meant that Barb and her friends were about 74 feet too close. So there was nobody was going to come along and rescue them, right? There were no cars on the roads, and they were having to stare down these bison who were in no hurry. But as it happened, eventually they were rescued, and a truck came along. It was a park employee, and he said, "Here, I'll get you out." And he went over to the far left of the road, and the bikes were able to go around him. But that only happened after a lot of worry and fear, really. I mean, bison are no joke. They are very deadly. I think there was just a story recently about how dangerous they can be.
They will charge you, definitely,
They will.
and can kill you essentially. They do a lot of damage to you if they get you. I want to talk about that you have a bunch of people in the book over 100 years, of course. I want to talk about a couple of these gentlemen who feature prominently over several chapters. One is Pete Peterson. There's a photograph of Odell Pete Peterson with his wife, Edith Pinky Peterson. There's a story there, I think, right?
Getting back to Wasatch Matrimonial Club, yes.
Matrimonial Club, and how Pete came to name Pinky Pinky, right? There's a story
That's
there.
right. So by the 1930s, people had cars, but not everybody did. So a club member who had a car would go around and pick up everybody else and then proceed on to a ski destination. Well, when they got to Pinky's house, she was still wearing her pajamas, so she just threw her coat over her pajamas, which is kind of hard for me to imagine going skiing in your pajamas, but they were pink pajamas, and from then on she was Pinky
She was Pinky for the rest of her life, I think.
for the rest of her life.
So this was 1938 that they met, and you recall a previous 1936 climb, the Tetons, I think. There's some other climbs in the Tetons as well. Tell me about that with the equipment of the time. There's some tricky places in the Tetons.
Yes, there are. Of course, they didn't know it back then, as far as they didn't know their equipment was as rustic as it was. They just had, hobnail boots. And back in 1936, few people had climbed the Grand Teton. And so the park had didn't have a guide who knew the summit, the way to the summit. So they appointed a guy named Wally Watson, and similar to the Lone Peak story, he was armed with some handwritten instructions and a vague map. But the route that they went was the Owen Spaulding route that had been initiated in 1895, I believe it was. And it has some scary stuff. There's something called the Teton Crawl, where you have a ledge above you, about 18 inches above you. Now you can actually get around this thing, but that was on, oh, you had to do what your forebears did. You had to crawl on your tummy across this with a 2,000-foot drop. And there's something called the chin up, where you have to pull yourself up a wall. There's a boulder that you have to pull yourself around. It's scary stuff. But what happened to them is they ran into some weather when they were almost to the top. This is Pete Peterson's 1936 climb, and they run into weather. They have to take shelter, and they're crouched on a ledge. And to fit everybody under the ledge, they are touching knee to knee, shoulder to shoulder. Well, a lightning bolt passes through them, one end to the other, and their hair is standing on end. And it's pretty frightening because you are almost all the way up the Grand Teton. And this is where the title comes. Pete says, "Well, faint heart never climbed a mountain." And so they brush themselves off as soon as the lightning stops, and they go on up to the top.
I guess that you're right. That's the spirit of the club, spirit of anybody who does those kind of activities. This bravado, right? You have to have
Oh,
a, you have to have
bravado.
courage. Yeah, for sure.
There.
You're testing yourself out
Yes,
there.
yes.
Yeah. So it Pete's interesting. Pete and Pinky. I guess they moved to San Francisco for a time, but you write the Golden City couldn't compete with the Pole of the Wasatch. So back they come in 1941.
Absolutely. Yes. You can't imagine the club without Pete, and you can't imagine Pete without the club.
Yeah.
He really was very integral, and he ran a shoe repair shop, and mended a lot of club members' boots, but also served as a club headquarters. He'd answer the phone and give directions, register people for hikes, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, 70 years he was a club member.
Really? Wow. And a lot of those years, I guess, this was headquartered in the shoe shop there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was interested to read that. So Pete became, I guess, head of the Rock Squad, the kind of the rock subdivision of the Wasatch Mountain Club. And so they'd go out to this certain place to train, but that was a little too far to go. And then they discovered a perfect rock just up Wasatch Boulevard.
That is right, around 5600 Wasatch Boulevard. It's right at the trailhead for Olympus, Mount Olympus. And you can see a plaque there that was dedicated to Pete back in 1912. He died in 2000, 2001, I believe. But it was named for Pete. He and another guy who had started the rock climbing squad. When they discovered that outcropping, they found that there were 13 and later 14 distinct routes on this one piece of quartzite. So they back then they took their spray paint and numbered the routes, and beginners could learn to climb on it, and experts could find the most challenging routes as well. Even the famous climbing family, the Lowe family, George Lowe, Mike Lowe, these guys learned to climb on Pete's Rock.
Yeah. So hiking, you have a chapter on hiking. This is kind of the heart of the Wasatch Mountain Club, right? There are a lot of other activities, but I just want to read this from this chapter. Unintended hard hikes. Sooner or later, most club members will find themselves on a harder than expected hike, faced perhaps with a knife edge crossing, steep drop offs on both sides, or an exposed scramble on loose scree, or even an unexpected swim. I once heard about club hikers who descended a 12-foot cliff only to find themselves facing an icy swim in a 6-foot deep stream because they couldn't get back up the cliff. Glad I missed that one, you write.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have here, this is page 122, Wick Miller's Glossary of Hiking Terms. So exposure So some people define exposure as a place where there's little danger of falling, but if you do, you're dead. So exposure, rock scrambling, bushwhacking, and to Wick's list, you would add exploratory. If a trip organizer isn't familiar with the hike, it's a get out of jail free card. they just label it exploratory, I guess. I wanted to talk about that. You have several places in the book where you talk about. That's one of the advantages of joining the club, right? You get sort of somebody who presumably knows the way, but sometimes they don't, or things happen. And it turns into a much harder hike than it should.
Right. I mean, the club started off with explorers, and the club is still exploring. And you mentioned Julie Kilgore earlier. She's one of the queens of exploratory. It's, you know, it's part of the adventure.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just turns out to be much more than you expected.
I wanted to skip to the last chapter, Discover Don. This, he sounds like a quite the guy.
Yes.
So this is bringing it up to, you know, more modern times, 90s and the early aughts. And one section of this chapter is called Death March Don.
Yes.
So Don, I guess, was notorious for really pushing the envelope.
Yeah, I mean, that might be a little unfair to Don, but he lives with it.
Yeah.
that particular story was to Kessler Peak, and he co-organized it with Stanley Chang, and they estimated that it would be like 3,000 elevation gain, and typically it was cooler than 90 degrees. And so what happens in that situation is you're fine for a while, and then you run out of water. You get too hot, it becomes miserable. And, you know, I had that happen to me once. I went on a hike that was not exploratory per se, but it was new to me. And it was advertised as a 5 mile round trip hike. And at about the 5 mile point, everybody pulled out their lunches. And I said, "What's going on here?" And they said, "Well, you know, we better eat and fortify so we can do the rest of the hike." And it went from a 99 degree, very steep hike up till we reached snow. And this was on the way up to Lone Peak. We were going to Outlaw's Cabin. Well, the 5 mile round trip hike turned out to be 13 miles. And
yeah,
it was not a comfortable experience, but it was a learning experience. We'll look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. One of these hikes, can't remember which, was Don organized. He said, we got to the end, all just really, really tired. There would have been a mutiny, he said, if the Pizza Hut hadn't been open at the end of the hike there.
That's right. You're often in very remote places, and it's not like you can just choose from a bunch of restaurants or stores.
Yeah, yeah. One section here, Dale Green and his measuring wheel. I guess you want to know how far is this exploratory hike, I guess, right?
Okay, yeah. Dale Green meant to take a little bit of the exploratory out of it, some of the uncertainty out of it. He was an engineer, and in the early 60s began measuring all of the hikes that the Wasatch Mountain Club was then doing. He wanted to take into consideration not just the distance, but also how challenging the hike was overall, whether there was scree to have to move through, or bouldering, or river crossings. Those sorts of things add to the difficulty. So he sought to both measure and then account for all the things that make it more difficult. And the interesting thing is later on, when we had GPS to use, Dale's old measuring wheel did the job really well. The GPS tends to confirm what he discovered.
Yeah. Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about another very prominent individual, Harold Goodrow. Is that how you say his name?
Harold Goodrow.
Yeah, he's involved with, I think, at least hiking and climbing. and
Skiing.
several things. And there's a very interesting story about what was supposed to be a fake emergency in the mountains. It turned into a real emergency, where a plane was supposed to fake crash, but it actually did crash. We'll tell a couple of those stories from Harold Goodrow following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today is Salt Lake City author Deborah Frank. She's out with a new book called Faint Heart Never Climbed a Mountain. Subtitle is A Century of Adventure, History, and Exploration from the Wasatch Mountain Club. And that is available at deborahwilsonfrank.com or at the King's English Bookshop at this point. So I mentioned Harold Goodrow. He's involved in several chapters here. One thing I want to have you tell me about is his, with a friend, Kane Alder. This is 1961, I believe. He wanted to climb as many peaks as possible in one day, just to set a personal record. Where did they choose?
Oh, boy. So they started at Mount Millicent, and they ended at Lone Peak. And as we've already seen, Lone Peak is a full and arduous day for most experienced hikers. But for Harold, it was only the very last, it was the 18th peak in one day.
Wow.
Kane Alder went, started with him, but he dropped out after the sixth peak. And Harold said, well, he just wasn't feeling well. I don't think I would have made it past the third peak.
Mm-hmm.
And the sixth one was Devil's Castle, which is notorious for being very jagged. And we can get back to that word exposure, where it's a sharp fall down and you are on knife edges. But Harold, yeah, he did it.
He did it. Wow. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And then it really stood out to me, one of the highlights of the book, I think it's also 1961. Harold Goodrow went to Peru.
He did. He made a name for himself as a mountaineer. And the Iowa Mountaineers, which I always think sounds like the Jamaican bobsled team,
mm-hmm.
You know, they have their highest point is about 600 feet elevation. But the Iowa Mountaineers were a very serious group, and they traveled all over the world. And they hired Harold to take them up in the Peruvian Andes, in the Cordillera Blanca. And there, the prize is Huascarán, Mount Huascarán, which is over 22,000 feet in elevation. And so Harold fell in love with Peru and went there several times. But he, on that first trip up Mount Huascarán, nobody made it all the way up. Mm-hmm. Harold came close with a guide. Yeah.
And there was a death, I guess, nearby. Somebody fell in a crevasse.
Yes. There was a Spanish team on the mountain at the same time that came over from the other side, and they lost a person in a crevasse. It's a very interesting story because Harold told it differently when I found his story in the archive, and described actually being evicted from his tent by gunpoint when the local police came to investigate the death and retrieve the body.
There was a superstition among some of the folks.
Yes.
The locals.
Right. Harold had hired a porter, you know, the equivalent of a Sherpa, to help carry equipment. And and the porter, when he learned of the death on the mountain, became very afraid, because for these people, for the natives, these are descendants of the Incans, their whole livelihood depends on that mountain. If there's a landslide, a mudslide, a snowslide, that can take them out. But it also regulates how their crops grow. They're extremely dependent on the what they would consider to be the spirits of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
whether the spirit is good to them or bad to them. And he was afraid he was bringing on a bad outcome.
You have a tragic epilogue here, not far after this 1961 ascent. There's a huge earthquake.
It was devastating. It took out whole cities. And Yungay, where the porter was from, it just got sloshed in mud, but it took a lot of cleanup. But a subsequent time in 1970, Yungay was destroyed. You see pictures now of it, and there is just an overturned bus, a smashed church. That's about it, the remnants of a cemetery.
Yeah, very, very, very tragic, those
Very
earthquakes.
tragic.
Yeah. By the way, Harold Goodrow, he went back several times with the Iowa Mountaineers and Wasatch Mountain Club as well. And for his final trip in 1989, you write, when he was 73, he underwent bypass surgery, which is preventive bypass surgery, I might point out, because his doctor deemed this necessary to survive the altitude. So he had the surgery in order to go.
He did. He loved Peru. I think he even said it was the highlight of his life. As much as he loved, carrying his pack around the Wasatch, he also loved exploring new places, and he fell in love with the people and the culture.
I'll just read, just have a couple minutes left here. I want to read this from, this is Julie Kilgore, who we referenced earlier. She says, "My grandmother advised me many times that to live a well-balanced life, one must feed in equal parts the mind, the body, and the soul. For me, hiking does all three at the same time," which is a wonderful quote. And then you have here at the beginning of chapter four, Brad Yates, who says, "I just don't know any better."
Yes. Yes. Brad Yates.
Reasons to hike, I guess.
Oh yes. It's good for you. It's fun. You can start anytime. You can start slow. You can aspire to be a Brad Yates or a
Yeah.
Harold Goodrow.
We encourage you to find the book. We haven't even talked about caving or boating. There's a chapter on avalanche, snowshoeing, canyoneering, a lot in the book. Just about a minute left. So, Deborah Frank, what would you like people to take away from the book, from the discussion?
I would say we live in this fabulous place. There is so much to see and explore, and get out there and do it, I would say. We have club members who are in their 80s and still hiking. I think it keeps you young. It is a beautiful experience, and you make a lot of friends along the way. And the Wasatch Mountain Club really offers unlimited activities because we canyoneer, we hike, we snowshoe, we ski, we boat, we bicycle, we get married.
Yeah, that's right. Very good. Wonderful. And you can read all about it in this new book. It's called Faint Heart Never Climbed a Mountain, A Century of Adventure, History, and Exploration from the Wasatch Mountain Club. We've been talking with the author of the book, Salt Lake City author Deborah Frank. Deborah Frank, thank you so much. A pleasure.
Thank you so much, Tom. I really enjoyed being here.
Let me just, before we close, tell you where you can get the book, DeborahWilsonFrank.com, probably the easiest way to get the book. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.